Connect the Dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon, Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you this show every Saturday at noon Eastern Time to connect the dots between health, our media, our beliefs, our environment, and our society, and our larger global, biologically dynamic and alive reality. As you know, on Connect the Dots, we connect health, the environment, society, and activism. And we've done a lot of shows recently on the nuclear event and issue that has now come front and center onto our plate, as well as spoken with a number of environmental scientists. So on today's show, it's really my great delight to be speaking today with Hunter Lovins, who is someone who has some economic solutions and proposals of how we can begin to build and implement a new green economy. She's the author of a new book called Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change, which shows that sustainable practices and economic profitability can go together. She's also the founder of Natural Capitalism Solutions, and she has been working as a leading organizer, thinker, and icon in this field for many decades. So I'm so pleased to have you with us today, Hunter. Thank you so much for being on Connect the Dots.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is really exciting because, you know, because of my own background as a health journalist and then extending that into the health impacts of some of these environmental harms that we allow to occur and persist, you know, which affect our environment, our food, global warming, all of that really translates down to the human being in our own sort of selfish way, you know, as health impacts. So in effect, what we have going on, it seems like, is a bit of a struggle in terms of our social values. Do we choose health in the environment, what's healthy for us, what's healthy for the environment, or do we choose some kind of economic grounding and make that primary, you know, when we make our decisions? So we choose things that are profitable to certain sectors, but maybe, you know, have a lot of downstream health or environmental harms. So my question to you is, do we have to choose?
No, that is very much a false trade-off. And this is increasingly being proven by folk like those wild-eyed environmentalists at Goldman Sachs, who recently released a study showing that the companies that are the leaders in environment, social, and good governance policies have 25% higher stock value than their less sustainable competitors. Similarly, the Economist Intelligence Unit showed that the companies with the highest share price growth over the past 3 years paid more attention to sustainability issues. Conversely, the worst performing companies in the economy were most likely to have nobody in charge of sustainability. And A.T. Kearney showed that even in the 08 collapse, the sustainability-focused companies outperformed industry peers in 18 industries studied, and had market capitalization averaging $650 million more than their less sustainable competitors. In fact, we now know that the correlation runs the other way round, that if we want strong economic performance, as we've recently witnessed in Germany, the country that is now bailing out the pigs economies that are failing, it comes because you unleash the new green economy. Because Germany put in place policy measures like a feed-in tariff, which pays more for green electrons, they are on track to be 100% renewably powered by 2050 and are generating more new jobs in the green economy than in any other sector in Germany, are generating the economic health that allows them to become Europe's banker are cutting the cost of technologies like domestic solar panels to the point where they are now competing with building any kind of dirty, dangerous, centrally operated power station like, say, coal or nuclear. We can have that in this country. Tom Friedman, in his article a bit over a year ago, Have a Nice Day, pointed out that Applied Materials, a U.S.-based company, San Jose, California-based company, that makes the machines that make solar panels, was over the next year opening 14 of these facilities around the world. In Germany, in Spain, in Italy, in India, in China, how many in the U.S.? Zero. Have a nice day.
Shocking.
Similarly, in Sonoma, California, where the county put in place a financing initiative called PACE Financing, Property Assessed Clean Energy, which allowed citizens, small businesses, to install energy efficiency, put solar up on their roofs. Within the first 9 months of the program being in place, construction jobs went up 8.4%, even in 2009. This is the heart of the recession. In neighboring Napa County that did not have the program, jobs went down 3%. So if what we want is jobs, prosperity, economic vitality, manufacturing industry in the United States, we know how to get it. It's to unleash climate capitalism.
Please define what you mean by climate capitalism for our listeners here on Connect the Dots.
We now practice what Randy Hayes, founder of Rainforest Action Network, calls cheater capitalism, in which we are subsidizing, out of your and my tax dollars, the incumbent industries, like the oil industry that allowed BP to spill oil all over the Gulf, or the natural gas industry that's pouring poisons into the fracking wells in Pennsylvania and western Colorado and many other places around the country, like the nuclear industry that recently had the meltdown at Fukushima. Around the globe, the International Energy Agency reckons that we spend $550 billion each year on just the fossil industries to make oil and gas and coal look cheaper than they really are. Climate capitalism would start by unleashing the entrepreneurs, by enabling market mechanisms to work in our communities so that we can innovate our way out of this problem. We can end the subsidies, be a good place to start, although these incumbent industries have enormous well-funded lobbies. For example, in California, the Koch brothers, oil and coal companies, spent over $10 billion to try to convince voters to overturn the Republican governor's cap on carbon emissions and climate protection initiatives. Happily, the voters in California rejected that, rejected it overwhelmingly, and California is going ahead in creating a market in saved energy, in saved carbon. The University of California at Berkeley reckons that fully implementing this program would add over $76 billion to the state economy and create over 400,000 new jobs. So climate capitalism is an approach that asks, what are the best ways to meet our needs for services, whether it be health services or energy services or food or transportation or buildings? How do we best achieve this within a genuine market in which all of the technologies can compete freely? How do we provide real information to consumers so that they can make informed choices? And to the extent that there are market imperfections, very real barriers in people's way, how do we identify and clear those barriers? Or, as in the case of Germany, how do we set policy so that the system works as if we had a real market? Now, you could say in the case of the German feed-in tariffs, won't that just raise everybody's rates? Yes, it's true, it does. In Germany, the feed-in tariff meant that German electric customers paid about 8.4 billion euro more than they historically had. However, a recent study by Deutsche Bank has shown that if that program were not in place, if the German utilities simply continued to burn coal as in the old way, German customers would have paid 9.6 billion euro more. So either way, you're going to pay more. It's just you're going to pay less more than you would have with the fossil industries if you implement solar. This is why Germany, which has, well, California has 70% more sun than Germany. Germany has 15 times the amount of solar installations that California does. This is silly. And if we, again, if we wish to have the job creation, the clean energy, the cleaner air, the stronger economy, we can get that just by putting in place good policy.
Well, you know, that brings up an excellent point because, you know, they're, you know, right now, and you know, we don't know for how long, there, you know, is a bit of a stalemate in getting good regulations and good policies. This is something, you know, that I cover a great deal in covering health in terms of the role of the FDA in health, in managing food, the USDA in regard to food, you know, with the, you know, the Monsanto influences in all of those agencies. We have revolving doors. The fracking issue is one that, as a New York State resident and Huffington reporter, I've covered exhaustively, and my listeners, you know all about that. But you know, it's been just, you know, a huge grassroots fight to, you know, to create some pushback in the regulatory area. And in fact, the whole fracking process was really, you know, given a carte blanche by regulations initiated by the Bush administration, you know, with the former Vice President Dick Cheney leading the charge. So, you know, the sense is that with the lobbyists out there who are, you know, over the last year, you know, Senator Frank Lautenberg has been trying to pass the new Safe Chemicals Act against chemical industry opposition. You know, what is the consumer pushback, A, in terms of getting the kinds of policies we need? And also, I think one of the things that I see in the Post, in the Huffington Post, when I cover these energy stories, is that people are also concerned about how long a transition it will be. You know, the sense is I have to fill, I have to tank up my car now. you know, I have to heat my house now. How long, you know, ahead of us is this to, you know, from the consumer side for a transition to be put in place? And then if that is, you know, more rapid than many people are currently aware, what is then the pushback, you know, to kind of unseat the interests of these entrenched industries?
How long it will take to have a transition depends entirely on how hard we all push and to what extent we allow the market to truly function. It can happen very rapidly. Communities like the island of Samsø in Denmark have already gone 100% renewably powered. There are German cities that are 100% renewably powered. There are buildings in the United States that produce more energy than they use, that capture rainwater on site, that treat their wastes on site. We can have a much higher quality of life, a much healthier life, a much more affordable life if we choose it. Each one of us makes these decisions every day when we spend our economic vote, when we spend our dollars. It's very tempting to say, well, yes, I know that, but and I'll be green tomorrow. If we make that choice, we will be facing some very tough times. I'm sure you all have as your bedtime reading the reports of the International Energy Agency. Actually, until 2007, it was great bedtime reading. It would put you right to sleep. The IEA was saying, the world's awash in oil, don't worry about it. In 2007, in a report, little noticed in this country, I read it in the Financial Times, the IEA warned that because of some idiosyncrasies in Mideast oil field supply, expect within 5 years some shortages of oil. well, it took less than a year for oil to hit $150 a barrel. And you know what happened 6 months later? The economy went off a cliff. At the time, the United States was borrowing $2 billion a day, largely from the Chinese and the sovereign wealth funds of the Middle East, to buy imported oil from the sovereign wealth funds of the Middle East in competition with the Chinese. This is daft. With the economic downturn in the recession, it dropped now to where we're only borrowing $1 billion a day. But oil prices are creeping back up. WikiLeaks recently let us know that the Saudis have been cooking their books, and they probably have 40% less capacity than they have been saying. In 2009, the IEA came out with another report, again warning that within 3 to 4 years, expect conventional extraction of oil to plateau and begin a steady decline. This, they warned, is not good news. And with, you know, the last time oil went over 100 a barrel, it took 6 months and the economy collapsed. Oil is again over 100 a barrel, and we're again in the danger zone. So if we choose business as usual, we are choosing a future that will be very grim. And not only for us, read at least the executive summary of Global Biodiversity Outlook 3. The study issued last May by Dr. Tom Lovejoy of the Smithsonian Institution, pointing out that we're losing every major ecosystem on the planet. Three of them are tipping into collapse. Coral reefs, sorry, scuba divers. The Amazon, this is a bit more serious. And then the oceans are acidifying because of the carbon dioxide we're releasing into the atmosphere. Now, this could be tilt game over for life as we know it on the planet. So we have, you know, every day, each one of us has a choice how it is that we're going to live our lives. I recently finished installing a 5-kilowatt solar system on my ranch in Colorado, oversized so that I can run a plug-in hybrid car off my own solar electricity. If you work at Google in California, you can drive your plug-in hybrid and park it in the shade of the solar panels on the Google parking lot and charge your car while you're at work. Companies like Better Place, founded by entrepreneur Shai Agassi, are proposing to sell you an electric car at a concessionary rate, just the way the phone company sells you a phone at a concessionary rate, because they're going to sign you up to use the phone service. Shai's going to sign you up to recharge your batteries in his renewably powered battery recharging station. At the same price point and in the same amount of time it now takes you to put gasoline in your car. Crazy idea, yeah? Well, he's doing it. He's done a deal with Danish Oil and Natural Gas, which, along with Siemens, the big German industrial conglomerate, is putting big wind power off the North German and Danish coasts, part of how Germany's going to be 100% renewably powered. And Renault is building electric cars that they'll sell you at $12,000 a car, which you then charge up in the Better Place recharging stations. Shai's also putting these into San Francisco to recharge taxi cabs. This is the sort of innovation that we ought to be investing in as communities, as a nation, as venture capitalists, and indeed clean tech. The green economy is now one of the hottest areas for venture capital because these guys think they're going to make a lot of money off it.
This sounds very hopeful and promising. You know, the whole time, because I've been involved with the grassroots community campaign to protect our water and air and sustainable agriculture in the Northeast from fracking, now that we've had this, you know, horrible revelation of what is entailed that we've seen in Pennsylvania. And all along we've been saying we just have to go to renewable. We have Indian Point in New York, for example. That's not going to be a solution. So it's not going to be an either-or of all of these endangering choices, really. So it's very hopeful to hear that things are progressing. What can, you know, you mentioned the choices that people, you know, make every day. I mean, usually those choices become the the focus. I know in the health community, it's all about what I can do individually, and then we kind of fail to address some of these larger business and regulatory infrastructures, you know, that function against, you know, our own best interests, against life on the planet. So, you know, I don't want to overemphasize that, but on the other hand, you know, I hear you saying we can make a choice, just, you know, the and, you know, it's not just about, you know, I mean, I certainly recycle and do all of that, but, you know, that we need to go further. What would that look like?
A really good place to start is what you put in your body. You've no doubt been talking about this. The food that you buy, it's awfully easy to just buy whatever's on the shelf or whatever gets advertised. If you dig just a little bit deeper, if you buy from local farmers, either in a farmer's market or through a community-supported agriculture where each week the farmer delivers to you a bundle of whatever he or she happens to be growing that week, if you make yourself a deal that wherever possible you're going to eat food that was produced within a couple hundred miles of where you live, your action, and even more importantly, your sharing what you're doing, why you're doing it, what it is you care about with your family, your friends, your neighbors, begins to aggregate into a whole network of economic vitality. I was just in Seattle eating at a restaurant called 350, which is 350 miles within that restaurant. Nothing in the restaurant comes from further away. And it was delicious. Mm-hmm. And it included alcohols and vegetables and meats and breads. And when you do that, it's a lot fresher. The week before that, I was in Nashville, where a restaurant called Taste sources essentially everything from within about 90 miles of where the restaurant is. And the chef spends his free time volunteering in the public schools to help bring good nutrition to the children there and help the children realize what they're eating, what's going into their bodies, how they're cooking it. This is following on the pioneering work of Chef Ann Cooper, who worked first in the Berkeley schools, now in the Boulder, Colorado schools, with community gardens, with school-based gardens, with teaching the children how to be a part of cooking the food that they're eating and insisting that it's only high quality, preferably organic, preferably locally sourced food. It turns out that this is also part of climate capitalism. How we run agriculture is critically important to whether we're pouring carbon into the air or taking carbon out of the air and sequestering it in the soil. The stories told by the early pioneers of crossing the Great Plains and finding the tens of feet worth of thick black soil, that's carbon. You go through that country now, it's down to inches worth. We've been decarbonizing the soil with industrial agriculture. Oh, and poisoning our own bodies.
Oh, yeah. This is a big area of concern. And actually, you know, I've reported on food for over 20 years and eaten just the way you describe, been a proponent of it forever, written a number of books in that department as well, and I'm now doing a kind of broader book that connects the dots between these various areas. But, you know, one of the things that I really would love your thoughts on is, you know, Michael Pollan famously asks in The Omnivore's Dilemma, do you know where your food comes from? And so I know that with the fracking issue that we just had, New York State, which is, you know, a very prominent state, it's a blue state, it's a state with upstate agriculture, upstate sustainable agriculture, as well as a kind of very food-oriented population down in New York City and all of that, is really facing a choice to choose between, you know, gas and energy, you know, as that's perceived to be, and the financial benefits of it to the companies involved, and water and upstate agriculture, because if fracking were to come into the regions of the upstate agriculture, New York City dwellers would trek into the farmers market and feel they're doing their bit and getting the healthy food that's good for them and that they love, and that food won't be there unless they make, you know, a legislative choice and press on the governor and all of their state representatives, as well as their national representatives, to make their voices heard about the kind of choice they would like to see. They'll be unwittingly, through not paying attention, really, to politics and to activism and to regulations and all of those little skirmishes and battles, unwittingly sacrificing water and healthy food to the high-powered, well-lobbying, you know, moneyed gas interests that are pressing on these same legislators and regulators all the time through sheer ignorance. And, you know, the sense is always, well, I can go to the farmer's market and therefore I voted and I've done my bit. But, you know, there needs to be more. There needs to be more activism. And in my observation, having reported on all of the range of issues we're discussing, there's a disconnect. There's a disconnect. You know, there are some people who sign up for, you know, to follow Millions Against Monsanto or Food Democracy Now, you know, on the GMOs. And there are some, you know, and now more and more young people, thankfully, who've gotten really involved in the fracking issue and really see the problem and have made it a kind of leading edge environmental issue for, you know, the next generation, which, you know, thrilled to see that. But there's been a kind of disconnect about this, as if consumer choice alone will win the day, but not if you allow these legislative policies and regulators to overturn those interests. How do we engage people better in that regard and wake them up more to the need for that? Perhaps in California, there's less of a disinclination toward activism than what I see here on the East Coast. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Churchill once said, Americans can be counted on to do the right thing after they've exhausted all alternatives. And it's very tempting to say, oh, God, this is just one more issue. I'm already active in whatever community of interest I believe in. But your point is an excellent one. Fracking is one of these industries, nuclear power is another, where if it goes wrong, and it has been unfortunately proven in the case of both of them, that give it enough time and it will go wrong, it not only is a tragedy for that particular well or that particular county or that particular region, but it begins to spread across and affect the lives of all of us. If fracking is allowed to go ahead in New York, in the watershed of New York City, this could well poison everyone living in New York City. It gets into the water supply. Once it's in the water supply, you cannot get it out. For those of you who don't know, fracking involves injecting under high pressure very nasty, terribly toxic chemicals to break apart the rock so as to release the natural gas. Well, having broken apart the rock, you've also spread these chemicals into the watershed. And in places in western Colorado, you can literally light streams on fire. You can literally light the water that comes out of some people's home water taps on fire because of the gas that's now in the water and because of these chemicals. There was a case in Durango where a young man broke his leg working on one of these fracking wells, was taken to the local hospital. A nurse went to pull his boot off, and the chemicals on the boot put her into total organ failure. The hospital radioed out to the well and said, what are these chemicals? We need to know how to treat this woman. And the company in this case, imagine that, BP, said, oh, they're proprietary. In the event, the woman lived, but barely. And there is now pressure on the companies to release what these chemicals are, but they're horribly toxic. This is simply not something that we should be allowing these companies to do so that we can continue our wasteful, inefficient lifestyles. How do you fight that? Exactly as you said, you organize. You become politically active. You attend the local hearings. you insist that your local, state, national representatives take action on these, particularly because continuing to invest in these kinds of technologies per dollar invested produces one-tenth the number of jobs that we would get if we instead invested in energy efficiency, in renewable energy, in the technologies that we are going to have to invest in anyway, because they're the only route to the future. It's a question of, do we invest in them after we have ruined our economy, ruined our health, ruined the capacity of the soil to produce healthy food, ruined our watersheds? We're going to make this transition. Margaret Mead once said the only person who likes change is a wet baby, and I'd argue the baby squalls all the way through the process. But when you recognize that we really have no choice. We're going to make this change. It's just a question of, are we going to do it when we still can reap the economic value from it, or when we're under duress because our economy has collapsed, our health has collapsed. You look at, I'm sure you know Robin O'Brien's numbers on increase in childhood asthma. It's dramatic.
We have asthma, we have spectrum disorders, we have neurological ailments for adults, we have cancer in both childhood and adults, you know, at earlier and younger ages, and overall, we have lowered life expectancy for the next generation, as well as decreased longevity for adults, and very low ranks internationally below that of all other first world nations, you know, with this whole array. So those chemicals and all of that are coming from a wide range of different sources, and both agriculture, as you mentioned, as well as food products, as well as these very dangerous energy sourcing practices. You know, part of the problem, and I'm writing about this in my book, which I'm completing, called What Ails Thee, about the challenge to America's health. Part of the problem is that our science, our healthcare science, and our science overall has evolved in a manner where it's analytic, you know, so that we go down and say, oh, well, this molecule of this impacts that. But in fact, living biology is synergistic. And so all of these different things at tiny, minute little doses, and we don't really even have the toxicological science fully evolved, are really incrementally pervading us in our environment and having a whole range of long-lived effects. But we can't yet get our minds around it. So, for example, you know, in the gas drilling thing, if you go there, they'll say, well, it hasn't been proven that what we did impacted his well. You know, so it's like the burden of proof is transferred from, you know, the polluting entity to the individual following, you know, this kind of very minute analytic model, whereas you point out, you know, merely evidential observation will show that when these industries come in, you know, these pollutants travel, and you can't track it quite that way. We're not equipped to do it, really. So I think that's also part of the disconnect for people. They can't turn to science and say, we know, you know, absolutely, this caused that, and we've been entrained into thinking that otherwise we don't know, whereas we do. If you can light the water on fire, if your kids are getting sick, if someone, you know, goes into organ failure following a single exposure, that's telling you a lot. And also, because of the lack of disclosure of these chemicals, no one can study them. The doctors can't study them and say, oh, maybe we can find a way to help if someone is exposed. They don't even know. They haven't even begun that research. So.
Sure. And so the approach that we took in the book Climate Capitalism is to say, look, okay, you can't prove it. You can't prove beyond an absolute shadow of a doubt that climate change is occurring, that it's human-caused. Fine. Assume it's a hoax. Now, don't go to Vegas on the odds of that being true. But if all you care about is being a profit-maximizing capitalist, you'll do exactly what you'd do if you were scared to death about climate change, because we know how to solve these problems at profit. So let's go. If it turns out it's a hoax, we've made a lot of money. If it turns out it's real, we've made a lot of money. Oh, and we're well down the road to solving the problem. The book lays out in business in general, in energy efficiency, renewable energy, buildings, transportation, agriculture, in a whole array of industries, how behaving in a way that is more sustainable is also more profitable. So if we can't argue about the science, let's just argue on the economics. It's worth doing if you want jobs, if you want prosperity. And this is, if you will, an impeccably Tea Party-esque argument.
Bravo. Mm-hmm.
My friend Jim Woolsey used to run the CIA. You kind of have to worry about yourself when you have a friend who used to run the CIA. Jim is most assuredly not a liberal. He drives a plug-in hybrid car that he fuels off the solar panels on his roof with a bumper sticker on the back that says, "Osama bin Laden hates my car." He sees this as a national security issue, and I think he's right. It's also a competitiveness issue. If you go back to the first Industrial Revolution, when we invented commerce using water power to make iron and textiles, and then moved on to steam engines and locomotives, the innovation that drove that was in England. And at the time, the British Navy ruled the waves. The sun never set on the British Empire. This little island ruled the world. And then some fool found oil in Pennsylvania, and Henry Ford built a car. And Thomas Edison built a light bulb in General Electric. And power began to shift across the Atlantic. And we moved on to cars and petrochemicals. And by the time World War II rolled around, the manufacturing power of Detroit is what won the war. Then we moved on to the space race as the basis of prosperity. And the IT revolution gave us all these little things in our pockets with 3,000 songs on them. I really didn't know I needed one until I couldn't live without it. But what's next? We all going to be burger flippers? Remember, the city, the region, the nation that innovates rules the world. And right now we are allowing that innovation to go to Europe, to go to China. China has surpassed the U.S. as the world's wind power. In Rizhou, China, city of 3 million people, 99% have solar hot water heating. Why? Because the Chinese have realized if you get the production volumes up, you get the per unit cost down, and they're looking to export. The Chinese are investing very real money in green technology because they see this as their future. They know they can't continue burning coal. Right now, China is importing coal. The price of coal goes up about 10% a year. They are, sure, they are using it as a transition technology, but they're trying as hard as they can to get off of it for good economic reasons. The world's first green billionaire exists. He's a Chinese solar entrepreneur. In Baoding, China, the young mayor woke up one morning to find that the lake that the city surrounded had died. The industrial toxins from the car and textile industries had poisoned all the fish.
Wow.
He said, polluting first and cleaning up later is very expensive. We're going green. And has started inviting renewable energy and energy efficiency companies to come and locate in Baoding. And as a result, it's now the center of prosperity of that region in China. It's called China's Electronic Valley.
That's so interesting. You know, we're going to have to take a break here and come back to talk more about this. But, you know, what's striking me and what you're saying is we've had the wake-up calls. You know, we can wake up to this. I mean, we've had the BP spill. You know, God forbid, we've seen, you know, Japan has shown the lesson with the nuclear, where, you know, we're seeing about what's happened with the fracking and with the toxic chemicals. We've had the wake-up calls. So really it's a question of will we wake up, you know, rather than wait until we have a big even worse cleanup and a lot of other problems on our hands. So stay with us, listeners. This is Connect the Dots with Alison Rose Levy. I'm talking today with Hunter Lovins about climate capitalism. We'll take a short break and be back.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're every Saturday at noon. We're on the Progressive Radio Network with programming that talks, that connects the dots between health, the environment, our food, our economy, our beliefs, our attitudes, and our world. On today's show, we're talking with Hunter Lovins, the author of a wonderful new book called Climate Capitalism. I want to do our kind of shout-outs at this point to our readers to get hold of this book, which we've been discussing, that, that brings together decades of wisdom that Hunter Lovins has as a leader in both the environmental community as well as in the business opportunity and the economic opportunity for revitalization and regeneration making, you know, a better and healthier Earth rather than really kind of wiping ourselves out here, draining the last drop of fossil fuel for our energy needs. So in addition to your book, which I highly recommend to people, Hunter, what other ways are there that, you know, in terms of websites or activist groups or other ways that people can engage with you and with what you're doing and with what they need to learn and how they need to act to support this?
You can check out the Natural Capitalism Solutions website, www.natcapsolutions.org, natcapsolutions.org. On that are a lot of books that you can download for free. There are tools that you can download for free, including LASER, Local Action for Sustainable Economic Renewal, the City's Climate Protection Manual, and a whole array of papers. The, as you mentioned, the book Climate Capitalism, which is, I guess, 2 days ago, hit the top 10 Amazon policy books, has hundreds of
footnotes. Congratulations, that's great.
Yeah, nice surprise. It's loaded with footnotes, including organizations in each of the areas that it covers, from efficiency and renewable and buildings and transportation and agriculture and such, where you can get involved in your local community. The best approach that an individual can take is find those organizations in their own home, in their own county, in their own state that are working on these, and drop by and say, how can I help? These organizations always need help. They need your time. They need your ideas. They can always use your money. And then get involved. There will be a set of marches coming up on Mother's Day called I Matter, in which young people across the country are going to take to the streets demanding a future that works for them. You can join them. You can support them. You can write about them. Write your paper and urge that people come out for the march. And get involved with the issue that matters most to you, whether it be food or health or energy. All of these issues are interrelated. You can grab a hold of any of them, and they will take you to all of the others. It is a commitment by citizens to build a future that works for us all. That is really the only hope that we have for building the kind of communities we want, the kind of country we want, the kind of world that we want, as Buckminster Fuller said, a world that works for everybody.
Bravo. That sounds really, really terrific. And I really think it comes down to that. You know, I had Harvey Wasserman on the show talking about...
Oh, lovely person.
You know, yeah, he was terrific. I mean, I've had Helen Caldicott on the show, too. It's just been, we've had the most wonderful people. But one of the things that Harvey said that I thought was so funny was, and it's true, he said, you know, getting involved, getting active, joining organizations, working with others together on this, it's not a downer. It's actually fun. And it is. It's hopeful. It's fun. You meet all different kinds of people. You co-create something together. There's just been so much, and I would say too much, of the kind of, you know, kind of grit your teeth and do it on your own, succeed at whatever cost, you know, American attitude. And we need more of this kind of community thing. And this is actually a terrific way of engaging with it around what matters to you. So, you know, I really second that. I also, listeners to this show know that I do a weekly e-zine blog on Huffington, and also I'm on Facebook. People can get involved by going to my website, healthjournalist.com. and signing up for the e-zine, where you'll get the blog, the radio show announcements every Saturday, so you can just click through and listen to our great guests. I'll be doing one tomorrow morning for this show, and as well as I do action links. So I'll definitely link to, I'll look on your site and put in some of those Mother's Day events so people can get involved in that, Hunter. I think that's really, really terrific. I wish that you or someone in your group would work with some of us from the integrative health community to kind of do an analogous analysis of why doing some of the more low-harm therapies is not only of health benefit and proactive, but also of, you know, of an economic benefit, because I don't think we've ever made that case. And I think that the whole battle for health care reform and everything could be retooled into a battle for, not a battle, but an initiative, a positive initiative for better, healthier, more natural, proactive approach to health. So it would be great to get some creative thinkers in the entrepreneurial economic arena involved in that. And, you know, something maybe we can, you know, if that's of interest to any in your group, I'd love to talk to people about that offline, because it's been, I think, a big missing link.
In general, our side has allowed the other side to take the economic high ground to argue that, you know, as we started out the show talking about, well, you can have prosperity, or you can have jobs, you can have the environment, but then that's going to cost you jobs. If you have health care, oh my God, that'll bankrupt the economy. And none of this is true. And the analyses are starting to come in that when we invest in people, when we invest in the environment, when we invest in the transition to this new green economy, we drive economic prosperity, we drive job creation, we strengthen the health of the existing business community. We dramatically strengthen the health of small businesses, which are, after all, the economic engine of the country. We have a new tool out called Solutions at the Speed of Business that you can get information on the Natural Capitalism website that helps small businesses gain the same advantages of implementing sustainability that my team works with very large companies to help them capture. For example, a little company in Washington, D.C., a graphics company, recognized that their high-end plasma screens are still on even when they say they're off. It's called phantom load. Your television does this to you as well. So they plugged them all into a power strip. When they leave for the day, they click off the power strip, took their electricity bill from $220 a month down to $90 a month. Month in, month out, that goes right to your bottom line. Mm-hmm. We worked with a company out in California, makes tortillas, mi rancho tortillas. They had no interest in sustainability, except they want to sell to Walmart, which has now started to demand that its suppliers enhance their sustainability, measure their carbon footprint. And Joe Santana, the COO of Mi Rancho, came to us and said, right, what do I have to do? We helped him eliminate waste packaging, implement a lighting retrofit program. He'll be saving $450,000 over the next couple of years. Joe's now a big fan of sustainability. And doing this in every small business in our communities is what will drive community prosperity. Right now, a typical American community spends 20% of its gross income buying energy from outside. 80% of those dollars leave town. keeping those dollars in town by hiring people in the town itself to implement energy efficiency, to install solar, to begin producing food locally, to strengthen the small businesses within the community. This is the real route to economic prosperity. Whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, whether you give a damn about the climate, this is just good economic development. And it's the basis of American prosperity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, the other thing that's, I mean, in fact, in the integrated health community, people are all across the board because, you know, there's a value for some communities that are underserved in terms of, you know, health insurance coverage in getting that. And then there's value in other communities in really staying out of the conventional healthcare system and not being forced into it, you know, by mandated services for, you know, health approaches that are invasive or have adverse side effects or that we don't want for, you know, for personal reasons. People have a range of values, and there's actually a substantial libertarian streak, fairly wide swatch among the, you know, the integrative health leaders and community, as well as, you know, wanting to regulate in appropriate areas to protect food and natural resources and not just give the, you know, the food supply or the water away to these larger interests. So it kind of cuts in both directions, I think, quite often. You know, one of the things that also occurs to me a lot is my folks, in bringing us up and all, were Depression-era babies, you know, and they were always going around turning off the lights. And just everything, saving jars, you know, wouldn't throw things out. They'd clean it, they'd store it, they'd use it again. And it was really, it was funny because there was this sense of, oh, they're downers. We're here in America. We can kind of be so profligate with everything. But I've saved glass jars myself, because they kind of entrained me into it at a young age. And I often think I'm really, grateful for some of those, more conserving-oriented values. I'd love your thoughts on that kind of thing, too.
Well, the phrase conservative comes from conserve. The original Republican Party, the Teddy Roosevelts and such, were conservatives. Abraham Lincoln was the one who freed the slaves. I think there's a need for a deeper American conversation about what is the future that we want to build together. There's been a lot of fun made recently about being so vitriolic in our political debate, about everybody fighting and anger, and it stops being fun when people start shooting each other, and when being in public service is a dangerous profession.
Exactly.
I mean, you all need to take a deep breath and step back and say, look, we as a country, we're facing enormous challenges. We are a resourceful, resilient people. We've faced challenges before. Let's entrepreneur our way out of the challenges facing us. And let's leave our communities, our economy, our country, the world, a better place. How do we do that? What are the technologies? What are the honest economics? And start having an evidence-based conversation about these issues in a civil dialogue in which we stop defining people of a different political party as our enemies and realize that in the end we're all in this together.
Yeah, that's powerful. I think that's really, really true. So, you know, actually by looking at the economics of it, you know, you kind of have a way of functioning as a bridge and creating a kind of win-win, which is really what we need. It's not going to work otherwise if we don't have that win-win. I think it's very true and very important. And so tell me, are these companies really hearing your message? It sounds from what you're saying like they too hear the call and they're interested. They're not just – the most successful ones aren't just there trying to improve their bottom line at any price whatsoever, because that's the impression that, you know, that people can sometimes get. I know I do when, you know, we see people opposing initiatives that really – are core to people's health, for example. But you're saying that it's not just a uniform greed package at the highest corporate levels. In fact, there's, you know, many shades of black and white is what I'm deriving from what you're saying. I mean, what's your perception of that?
There's several interesting approaches to that. First of all, trust me, Walmart is not doing what it's doing out of the goodness of their hearts. They're making money at it by squeezing waste out of their operations, by installing renewable energy, by selling organic food. They're making money. And there's nothing wrong with that. And if that's what drives them, if it's driving them in the right direction, more power to them. Second, hypocrisy can be the first step to real change. General Electric, when it announced Ecomagination, just badged as green products they were already making. Some of the enviros screamed, greenwashing. True. However, within 2 years of their 2005 announcement, their green badged products had doubled in sales with back orders of $50 billion. GE had said they were going to cut their greenhouse gas emissions 1% by 2012. They actually hit 40% by 2007. And last year, in his letter to shareholders, Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE, pointed out that if Ecomagination were a separate company, it would be a Fortune 130 company, and that it had revenue growth twice that of all the rest of the company. So when what started out as a marketing campaign has become now central to the company's strategy. I think they're really serious about it. I'll know they've turned the corner when they stop building nukes. Although the fact that the Fukushima
we'll all be happy when that day comes. Thank you so much, Hunter Lovins, for being with us here on Connect the Dots today. And please, you know, check out Climate Capital listeners and come back next week at noon Eastern Time for Connect the Dots on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rivlevy, and have a healthy week.